Good evening. It is Tuesday night, June 9th, 2020. This is Ozarks at Large on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead tonight, our militant grammarian thinks we could use a word quiz, so she'll join us in our second half hour. Tomorrow morning on 1A, Minneapolis has a black police chief, but the spotlight has been turned on the city's white police union leader. He's called protesters terrorists and says his officers are being used as scapegoats. Good cop? Bad cop? A closer look at Lieutenant Bob Kroll. 1A, tomorrow morning, beginning at 9, on 91.3 KUAF. Arkansas's COVID-19 case total now more than 10,000 confirmed cases. Governor Asa Hutchinson says there are 340 new cases to the state's total, meaning there have now been 10,080 cumulative cases. The governor, who held today's press briefing in Pine Bluff, says there were 6 more deaths from the virus during the most recent 24-hour monitoring period, bringing that total to 161. Dr. Nate Smith, Arkansas's Secretary of Health, says there are more than 3,000 active cases in Arkansas, of which more than 2,700 are considered community cases. At today's briefing, the governor was asked if he expected this June wave of virus cases to be this many.
No. But it just illustrates the fact that, this is unpredictable. We haven't seen anything like this virus. And in fact, many thought that the second wave would actually be this fall.
He says there were nearly 4,900 tests conducted Monday, and the state continues to be on pace for 120,000 tests performed by the end of the month. Yesterday, the governor announced the state was not ready for any of the public health regions to move into phase 2 of reopenings, a phase that would allow for more lenient rules regarding such things as restaurant indoor capacity. State Representative Dan Sullivan from Jonesboro, however, has stated in a letter to the governor and on his Facebook page that many businesses in the northeastern part of the state plan to move to phase 2 on June 12th. The governor says he hasn't spoken with Representative Sullivan yet, but did say he would have more to say about possible regional moves to phase 2 at tomorrow's press briefing.
And I get letters from both sides. I get letters saying, you're going too fast, slow down, don't open things up. I get letters that says, you're going too slow, you got to open it up quicker. And so that's just one of the many letters that I receive. Dr. Smith and I try to make decisions based upon the public health guidance, based upon the data that we see, but also what is needed for the uniqueness of our state. We'll continue to do that, and we'll have further comments tomorrow during the session.
Meanwhile, this morning, Governor Asa Hutchinson signed an executive order forming a task force that will propose improvements to the ways policing is currently conducted in Arkansas. The governor says ever since the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer, communities in the state and around the country have been calling for better law enforcement training, increased racial understanding, and greater accountability in law enforcement.
And as everyone knows, I have a long history all through my public career with law enforcement. I identify with law enforcement. But the most critical element of law enforcement is trust, trust with the community, trust with individuals, trust that you're acting with integrity within the law. And obviously, with the death of George Floyd, and being seen across the nation, that trust has been undermined. And I think we've all learned that we can do things better.
The formation of the task force comes after the governor held conversations with Black Lives Matter protest leaders across the state. The governor says those protesters are genuine, sincere, and committed to changing the relationship between law enforcement and their communities. The committee includes some of those organizers, as well as law enforcement officials and city leaders.
I want to cover a little bit of the purposes of this task force. The members of the task force shall have the following duties: to review the adequacy of law enforcement training, policy, and operations specifically related to cultural, racial, and community relations, to study and analyze the processes for accountability, discipline, removal, and decertification of officers who do not meet the standards, including an evaluation for the creation and implementation of a statewide public database of complaints and resolutions concerning law enforcement officers. It's also to review community policing and how
that can be enhanced in Arkansas and more effective. To study the standards, requirements, and obstacles in recruitment, hiring, and retention of law enforcement officers, recognizing the important work that they do. Make recommendations to the governor on enhancing the trust between law enforcement and the communities, and make recommendations to the governor on improvements or changes needed to enhance the profession of law enforcement to ensure compliance with standards.
The governor notes the state's law enforcement standards were established over 45 years ago, and there hasn't been a comprehensive review of those standards since. He also emphasizes his support for the state's law enforcement, their dedication, sacrifice, and the critical role they play in public safety.
I also want to be clear that there will not be an agenda item on defunding law enforcement through this task force. Now, it is always a fair discussion as to how funding is used and where the needs are, and that discussion is fair and can be a part of this. But I've talked to the members of the task force, and this is not to take away from law enforcement. This is to enhance law enforcement.
The task force will be chaired by Fred Weatherspoon, who is the deputy director of the Arkansas Law Enforcement Training Academy. A local law enforcement leader, Washington County Sheriff Tim Helder, will also be part of the committee. Governor Hutchinson says the task force will submit a final report to him by the last day of December of this year. And on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large, we'll hear from two other members of the task force who have been involved in protests in their communities. This is Ozarks at Large. As the coronavirus has swept through Arkansas over the last 3 months, nearly 1,200 inmates at four state prisons have tested positive for the virus, along with 134 members of prison staffs. As part of the National Geographic Society's Emergency Fund for COVID-19 coverage, reporter Anna Stitt dug into what's happened inside prisons in Arkansas. Here's part one of a three-part series.
This is a prepaid collect call from an inmate at Cummings Unit. This call is subject to
recording. DeMarco Rayner has seen a lot of death in recent weeks.
Danny Woods, I knew him real well, and we talk almost every day. Kenneth Oden, I knew him real well. We were in the barracks together. Tony Harper, I knew him. Ronnie West, I knew him.
The Cummings Unit is Arkansas's oldest and largest state prison. It also became the state's largest hotspot for COVID-19. But it didn't start out that way.
I'm proud of what Winnie Kelly and her team has done. As Secretary of Corrections.
This is Governor Hutchinson on April 2nd. By then, the department had instructed wardens to quarantine new prisoners and shut down in-person visits from family and friends.
The key is there was no outside visitors, and that was put into place immediately because that's what brings the outside contact in.
But staff were still going home each day at the end of their shifts. On March 24th, a worker at another state prison farm tested positive for COVID-19. We talked with half a dozen prisoners in barracks throughout Cummins for this story. All but one asked to be kept anonymous, afraid of being retaliated against for raising concerns. But DeMarco Rayner says the risk is worth it. His mom and I talked with him over a staticky state prison phone line.
When we first started seeing news reports of the agricultural worker testing positive for COVID-19, everything kept going on as normal. They kept going to host squad, every other job assignment here, everything kept going. So no type of prevention measures had been taken at that point. No mask, anything was issued at that point.
Host squad is the prison term for the crew of inmates who work in the fields. Cummins has a more than 16,000-acre farm on land that used to be several slave plantations. Prisoners are still not paid for their work, only punished if they don't work. They're still supervised by guards on horseback. Each morning, everyone sits on big trailers to be driven to where they'll work for the day.
You had guys that was filing grievances about going to host squad and sitting together on a tight host squad trailer where it's impossible to be 6 feet apart.
He says the prison administration dismissed the grievances.
They responded to the guys like it wasn't a grievable matter.
So the concerned prisoners didn't go to work. and then they got punished.
Over 19 guys got road disciplines for not going to work, even though a pandemic was going on.
Grievances and disciplinaries are not public information, so it's not possible to report how many the prison has on record. But inmates have shared several. Disciplinaries are a big deal. They can mean losing access to calls and visits, or if they add up, staying in prison longer and going to isolation, also called the hole. Prisoners continued to work together on the host squad until April 11th, the day the first positive test came back. The state doesn't know how COVID-19 got inside the Cummins unit, but I spoke with a nurse at another Arkansas prison who tried to wear a mask in late March. She says she was told she had to take it off to avoid causing hysteria. Prisoners and staff at all prisons were required to wear masks by mid-April. But there's evidence suggesting compliance among staff was poor. In an internal email obtained for this report, Division of Correction Director Dexter Payne said hospitals were reluctant to accept prisoners because the staff dropping them off were not masked. As tests came back, the prison said it was isolating people based on whether they had COVID-19. Here's Governor Hutchinson on April 19th.
It's been segregated so that we have 8 positive barracks within Cummins, and we have 7 negative barracks.
But things on the ground didn't seem to play out this smoothly. Arkansas Department of Health Secretary Dr. Nate Smith said the state tested around 2,500 prisoners and staff at Cummins in roughly 5 days. But we found that not all the results showed up in the Department of Health's log until about 1 month later. Cummins contains barracks with as many as 62 people sleeping together in one open room. One prisoner reports that he was tested, then left inside a barrack with lots of sick people for 2 days. By the time his result came back negative and staff moved him to COVID-negative housing, he was running a fever and feeling weak. He says no one asked him how he felt or took his temperature before the transfer, and he didn't know where he was going until he got there. He later tested positive. That prisoner's COVID-negative housing was an old school. Department of Corrections records show that in an effort to separate negative and positive cases, the prison moved people to live there and in the visitation room, the law library, and temporary holding cells. 2 prisoners who spent time incarcerated in these spaces say they didn't have access to grievance forms to file complaints, didn't have access to phones to call their families, and had to bathe with a hose. One prisoner says staff refused to take him to a regular shower with hot water until he threatened to rebel and break some things. Beyond that, the holding cells don't have toilets. A prisoner housed near them says that for at least several days in early May, the people inside were not allowed access to a bathroom. He saw prisoners resort to peeing on the floor, and he saw them physically picking up their poop and putting it in the hall using a small trap door in the bolted door to the room. We requested from the Department of Corrections documentation of how often people kept in holding cells without toilets have been allowed to use a bathroom. They did not release the information. At the same time, some prisoners, like DeMarco Rayner, say they were never moved at all, regardless of test results.
I'm looking at a guy that tested negative right now, sitting beside a guy that tested positive, so it never changed. As a matter of fact, I can't ask a question. Well, wait, did you test positive or negative?
Negative.
And he said he tested negative. Your name is, what's your name, sir?
Bernier
Collins said he tested positive, so he's saying that he's made him sick now.
We asked the Department of Corrections for the number of prisoners who tested negative and positive for COVID-19 currently living in Rayner's barrack. Officials have not released the information, but 2 other prisoners who share a cell showed their results to us. 1 negative, 1 positive. Eventually, 65 Cummins staff and nearly 1,000 of its prisoners were confirmed to have COVID, including DeMarco Rayner. As COVID numbers inside Cummins were exploding, Governor Hutchinson emphasized that most prisoners were asymptomatic.
They're being cared for in terms of their medical needs. Almost all are asymptomatic. In other words, they're not showing symptoms.
But Rayner says he's confused about how that conclusion was reached.
In the barracks that I'm in, even though the majority of guys here had all of the symptoms, whether it's fever, chills, cough, shortness of breath, diarrhea, all the things that's associated with the COVID-19, even though the majority of guys had those symptoms, they basically just still kept us in the room saying that we were symptomatic. And that's one of the things that I'm still confused on to this day. How could we be diagnosed as not having the symptoms, but have 8 out of 9?
The head of the State Department of Health, Dr. Nate Smith, says symptoms must be communicated by the person experiencing them.
The only way to know whether someone has symptoms or not is to ask them. By definition, symptoms are things that people report.
But later in our interview, Dr. Smith said he doesn't consider prisoners to be reliable sources.
I've actually been in prisons and interviewed inmates and get a lot of stuff that is verifiably not true. And then, of course, a lot of statements that it's impossible to verify one way or the other. So we are, in this context, really less concerned about whether someone has symptoms or not and more concerned about whether they're infected or not.
DeMarco Rayner says no nurses checked on his barrack for 3 weeks after testing. He put in a sick call for COVID symptoms and didn't hear anything from a nurse until 4 days later. At least 11 COVID-positive Cummins prisoners have died in the last month. DeMarco Rayner is still processing the losses and how they've been talked about.
Now, the scary part about it is this right here. If you even look at the ADC, what they're saying, the statement that they put out on the news is that the first two guys that died, you're saying, quote, unquote, that they were both in their 60s and both serving life sentences. So they let it hang out there like they were old and serving life anyway, so their life doesn't have any type of merit to it.
Here's Governor Hutchinson on May 2nd when a reporter asked him to talk about those first two prisoners who died.
They've passed away. They were in the maximum security unit at Cummins, which means they either had a life sentence or they had a violent crime or they were disciplinary issues while they were in prison. So it was a very serious environment in which they are.
Rayner questions what that means for him as someone who's been locked up for 20 years and hopes to one day be released.
I caught my charge when I was 20 years old, but they sentenced me to life in prison. So the person that was involved in this crime that I'm here for is not the same person that's speaking to you on his phone right now.
The department posted the first five deaths on social media, then stopped announcing them. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Anna Stitt.
And tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, part two, a story from inside Cummins about a case of COVID-19, a rebellion, and a 29-year-old's death. That's on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large.
The country has settled into social distancing, but there are lots of things we still don't know about COVID-19. I'm Ari Shapiro. Join us live every weekday for the National Conversation with All Things Considered. We take your questions, how to stay safe, when your state might reopen, and we bring on experts to give you answers. The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.
The live National Conversation continues tonight at 8 on 91.3 KUAF. You can follow how COVID-19 is affecting our region and state at the COVID-19 update page at KUAF.com. And you can keep up with the latest news during our newscasts at 5:30 and 7:30 each morning inside Morning Edition with Antoinette Grajeda, and how local nonprofits are reacting to the virus and are trying to help. That's on the Community Spotlight every weekday morning at 6:30 and 8:30, hosted and produced by Pete Hartman. This is Ozarks at Large.
Thaden School is now accepting applications for students entering grades 6 through 12 during the 2020-21 academic year. Located in downtown Bentonville, Thaden educates students from across Northwest Arkansas. Applications and information at thadenschool.org.
And ahead on our program, vending machines stocked with masks and hand sanitizer have been installed at XNA.
As we are seeing things go back to somewhat of normalcy, slowly, we want to make sure that our passengers have every option available to feel comfortable when they're ready to travel.
That story from Antoinette Grajeda in about 15 minutes on this edition of Ozarks at Large.
At a time when many of us are isolated from one another, you turn to public radio to keep you informed and connected with your community. KUAF and NPR's commitment to you will not waver. Our mission is to serve you. Your needs are changing fast, and we'll continue to provide the context you need to understand not just what's happening, but why it's happening. We'll bring you stories of others like you, grappling with circumstances both similar and entirely different from your own. And we'll find new ways to keep you connected with each other through music, arts, and entertainment. This commitment has always worked both ways. We serve you, and when you're able to, you donate to keep public radio going. You are the reason our reporting is possible. We know not everyone can afford to donate, but when you donate to KUAF, you'll be powering everything you get from us, with whatever you can give. To contribute, please go online to supportkuaf.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. The pandemic is shifting almost every business operation. We're keeping track of how some niche businesses are faring during the outbreak in an ongoing series we call Business as Unusual. Food Recovery Solutions is a Northwest Arkansas-based firm that has been collecting food scraps and converting that material to compost for area gardeners and farmers while diverting it away from the landfill. Much of the food came from restaurants until this spring. But a larger partnership with employee-owned Harps Foods grocery stores is helping both businesses. We recently talked via Zoom with Richard Ems, the owner of Food Recovery Solutions, and Mike Roberts, the director of produce operations for Harps, about the partnership, which Richard says actually existed before the pandemic.
Reached out to Harps last fall and inquired about beginning a partnership with them and hauling food waste to divert it from the landfill to create all natural compost for area gardeners and farmers. And Mike is really the champion there, I would say sustainability champion at Harps. And it's always easier to deal with a customer who has that kind of dedication because it's mission driven and not just straight business, although it's always business as well. But there's meaning behind that. So Mike said, along with his leadership, said they were willing to do a pilot up in Bella Vista at store 175. And they were doing a facelift there. It was good timing. And we started afresh there. And it turned out so well that we've since done an expansion with Harps stores.
Mike, what works in this for you and for Harps?
Well, I mean, it's we're a service, you know, I mean, we have to service our communities and we have to provide them with food. And I think with that comes with a responsibility to help every community that we serve. And especially being in Northwest Arkansas, if we're diverting stuff from the landfill and having it go to good use, plus helping out a local business, that's just a win-win-win for us. It's almost a no-brainer. We were using some other facilitators for that before, and you know, when we got with Richard and started exploring this, you know, we had plans to expand with him before the COVID situation came up. But to Richard's point earlier, I mean, when it did hit and they were kind of in a bind with losing all the restaurants, it just seemed like the perfect time to do that.
How does it physically work, Richard? How does the food that gets diverted out of a Harps grocery store get to compost?
So we place bins. These are 64-gallon totes that are on two wheels, a flip lid, and we place them we're in 10 different Harps stores, and so generally they're going to go in the produce section and the deli section, and so each of the staff members get aligned with that, and luckily many support the mission, the feel of the mission, sustainable mission as well. So the food, and it's a little bit more of an ask for them because you can't put plastics and things in there. So they are committed to separating that out, putting the material that can be composted into the red bin. And we have an organics truck that comes around on a regular schedule and picks up those bins. It's got a compostable liner in it, a tipper on the back of the truck tips in, and a fresh liner goes into the bin. And then we get it to the composting site. And then that compost, when it's finished in a few months, is available for area gardeners and farmers.
Mike, it's been mentioned that you started with the Bella Vista store as it was going through a sort of remodel. You've added 9 stores since. You're an employee-owned business, I think the largest in Arkansas. Does that make it a little bit more, are you a little bit more nimble to try an expansion like this in a short notice?
Yes. I mean, you know, even though we're, you know, Harps has gotten, we've continued to add stores over the years, and we've gotten to be a bigger company, but we're still small enough to be able to move on a dime, as I kind of speak. So when we run across opportunities like this where it gives us the opportunity to make an impact in our communities, I mean, we are able to act very quickly on that and get it done.
Mike, I suppose in a perfect world, you'd get just the right amount of carrots and radishes that would be bought, and just as you're running out from demand, more comes in. But we know that that doesn't happen. I'm going to guess there's art and science involved to figuring out how to put produce on shelves.
That could be its whole interview. you know, I mean, there is a lot that goes in that, everything from space allocation to looking what you ordered at last year, and, you know, consumer trends, and there's a ton that goes into it. It's never a perfect world. There is a lot of produce and a lot of perishables that go, they end up in the trash. And, you know, it comes down to imperfect produce. If you get something with a scar on it, I mean, it may be great, but the consumer doesn't want it. So really, I mean, it's become a passion of mine. I've been working produce for 32 years. I've seen a lot of stuff go in barrels. And really, I think that about around 45-50% of everything that is grown in this country ends up in the trash by the time you go from the field to the, you know, to the packing house, to the warehouse, to the grocery store. And then a lot of it is actually in the consumer's refrigerator. So a lot of what we do goes in the trash. And that's been a passion of mine for several years to try to reduce that.
What it's been able to do for us in partnering with this expansion with Harps is certainly, honestly, save us because of the volume drop that has taken place with restaurants, for example, which we are tied to so tightly with. So what it does is to still achieve a mission, and at least partially, and still be able to continue to divert food waste from the landfill and make it into something that we can use as a community. So the volumes that we lost from other accounts, hopefully just temporarily, hopefully those will come back. But certainly in the interim, we are able to still use that, as we call, as a feedstock into the compost, so that gets utilized. Compost, you can imagine, has been elevated in many people's minds because they're home, they start gardens, they want to grow some things now. So we sold out of compost. and without Mike and Harps being able to continue to feed that, we wouldn't have any in the fall.
Richard Ems is owner of Food Recovery Solutions. Mike Roberts is the director of produce operations for Harps Foods. We talked with them via Zoom late last month. This is Ozarks at Large. As more travelers begin flying out of Northwest Arkansas National Airport again, new vending machines will help them prevent the spread of germs during their travels. The machines were activated on the 1st of June and contain items like face masks and hand sanitizer. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
As restrictions related to COVID-19 begin to ease, Alex English, public relations and marketing specialist for XNA, says the airport has seen a little bit of an uptick in travelers.
We were seeing around 100-200 people a day at a maximum flying out, and we're seeing like 400-500 flying out. So positive uptick for XNA, but that is another reason why we thought these vending machines were so important, as we are seeing things go back to somewhat of normalcy slowly. We want to make sure that our passengers have every option available to feel comfortable when they're ready to travel.
The vending machines contain items like masks that are now required inside XNA. English says the airport is taking other precautions to protect passengers and staff, like placing markers on the floor to encourage maintaining 6 feet of distance from others.
We have hand sanitizing stations placed strategically throughout the airport still. We're still doing all of our cleaning. You'll probably see more custodial staff than you've ever seen at XNA cleaning and especially those touch points. We want to make sure and just attack those touch points at just constantly throughout the day. And then, you know, the airline counters and the rental car counters, they all have the sneeze guards up.
After having a discussion about adding vending machines containing personal protective equipment, English says the airport was contacted by a local company.
We had a conversation several weeks ago where we decided we need to have one of these vending machines. We were kind of seeing them popping up at different airports and in different areas, and we thought it was just such a great idea. So we knew we wanted to get one at XNA, and then that afternoon, not even just a few hours later, they contacted us.
Travel Clean Kit is a new Northwest Arkansas-based company that co-founder Heather Nichols says stemmed from an idea from her father, a retired Army and VA hospital registered nurse.
When he was doing some retirement traveling with my mom, instead of just cruises, he was doing flights. And he just was appalled at the touch points and the whole entire, he wasn't a heavy traveler before retirement, to be honest. So he just could not believe people were walking barefooted through TSA security check-in. He couldn't believe the bins people were putting their own handhelds into and items without any protective. You know, he just said, this is a breeding ground for all sorts of germs and diseases and communicable diseases, if you will. And so he came up with this concept. He said there needs to be something, a vending machine before people get into TSA, that if they don't have something to put over their feet, they don't have gloves, or they don't have a bin barrier, then we can provide that so that they can go through TSA without these touch points.
Nichols says they began their journey in October 2019 and officially became an LLC around the end of March.
Doing a lot of legwork research, trying to figure out how we could make this idea fly. And to be honest, I was working for another company as I am now. So it was kind of this side idea. And really, my dad was pushing it forward and, you know, hey, have you done this yet? What about this? I think we should do this. And I kept saying, yes, I'm getting to it. And so we finally got around to it. And then the pandemic hit and it became, wow, this might be more challenging and a better opportunity at the same time. So we kind of put it into high gear.
The company has installed two vending machines at XNA, one before the security checkpoint and one after. Travelers have the option of purchasing items individually, like a 2-ounce bottle of hand sanitizer produced by Westwood's Ancillary Global Resources in Springdale. Travelers can also buy a kit, which includes 7 individually wrapped items like a mask, vinyl gloves, and foot coverings for the TSA check line. Nichols says they were very conscious about the price of these items. The kit costs $12.95 and the hand sanitizer costs $3.50. Prices include sales tax and credit card processing fees.
We're not building in heavy margins just because of the convenience factor of XNA. We really want to provide a solution and do as many local people involved as possible. Keep it as domestic as possible. You know, there's challenges with as much demand as there is, but certainly not price gouge. You know, we're not looking for heavy margins on this. We're looking to have a business, not a hobby, but do it at a fair price point so that people have solutions and products.
Moving forward, Nichols says they're working on installing vending machines and customized kits in other locations like medical facilities or athletic venues.
Or different travel hubs, if you will, and even possibly hotels. So we might transition this into a hotel kit that is a travel clean kit, but it has, in fact, we're going to implement like maybe a sleeve for your remote control so you're not touching the remote. A pillowcase that's disposable so you can put it on the pillow that always sits on the comforter that never gets washed. So there's certain things that I myself would love to have. And so that's the birth of this, is how we can customize it based on where you are in your traveling needs.
Nichols says Travel Clean Kit is a new business that can help communities adapt to a new way of life.
Everyone has a new perspective on what it means to be in large masses and be, you know, with large groups of people. And we all want to live our life and we all want to live it as freely as we can. So what can we put in everyone's hands to give them an assurance and the confidence that they're doing the best they can in the situation they're in, but also not just, you know, for themselves, but for their neighbor? You know, the most challenging thing is for people to remember that the wearing the mask isn't for you. It's for everyone you're with, you know? So, I think that, you know, everybody's going to see that differently, and we respect that. And we just want to give people that want the items access to it conveniently and at a reasonable price point.
More information is available at travelqueen-kit.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
On tomorrow's Ozarks at Large, a new edition of Reflections in Black with Raven Cook.
Recently, I stumbled on a series about Black veterinarians. Strangely, I've never known any Black people who went into the veterinary sciences, so I was delighted to see this. But it got me thinking, who laid the foundation for these men? Who was the first?
Reflections in Black, the latest about COVID-19 in Arkansas, and what's next for people seeking criminal justice reform in our state, and more on a Wednesday. Ozarks at Large, tomorrow at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF.
Producing vaccines can take years, even decades. Scientists are aiming for a coronavirus vaccine in less than a year.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
We're in it to win it, buddy. Never fear.
But to meet that goal, they'll have to ramp up production before it's even certain a vaccine is effective.
We have a lot of confidence based on what we've seen so far in our animal modeling. The vaccine will work.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, tomorrow from 5 to 9 on 91.3.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
This is Ozarks at Large, continuing our social distancing versions of the military.
And there's a car.
That will happen. Just before we started this, there was a leaf blower going across the street, but it's gone now.
But Kyle's puppy is so sad to be in the backyard instead of at the living room window barking.
Yes, and if you listen very closely, you can probably still hear her protesting. Catherine Shields, our Middleton grammarian, what do you have?
Okay, Kyle, it's time for some more wordplay.
Good.
We need any escape we can find these days. The word jack, or a word containing that word, appears in many idioms. Let's see if you can identify these.
Okay.
What's the British emblem we're most familiar with?
Union Jack.
Right. If you're lucky, Kyle, you either are one of these or you married one. What do you call the handyman in your household?
It is not me, and that would be a jack of all trades.
Yes. And that's because, I guess, Laura is exceptionally adept at such chores, or do you hire it out?
Yeah. I mean, she's more of a jack of all trades than I am, but combined, okay. We're not.
If she were this, you would call her what?
If she were a jack of all trades?
Mm-hmm. If she were really good at certain things, which I know she is, but...
A cracker jack.
Yeah,
yes.
There you go.
So did that word come before the treat, or did the treat spawn the word, I wonder?
I didn't look that up. I'll bet it came well before.
I bet you're right.
Yeah.
I'll bet you're right.
You need to hire someone to run this handheld rock drill.
And it's not a leaf blower, it's a jackhammer.
It's a jackhammer. Someone, perhaps, who might resemble the burly Mr. Paul Bunyan, whose profession was...
A lumberjack.
Yes.
Huh. Do you think jack just means kind of an everyman, an every person?
It must. Okay. It must, yeah. After tackling those household chores or even spending time on the phone lining up a pro... You might be hankering for a particular type of hard cider.
Hard cider.
I've never had any. Applejack.
Wow. Yeah, that's going back. I haven't either, no. That's a cereal to me.
Oh, is it? Well, yeah. That's like, you know, Coke used to have cocaine in it. I wonder if the cereal has.
Had Applejack.
I'll bet a lot of these are being made these days because some people with kids at home have more time to make these breakfast treats.
Not a pancake, but a flapjack.
Yeah, that's right. Don't forget to keep up with your fitness regimen while you're homebound. And before you start working out, you might want to do a long-revered type of warm-up exercise.
Jumping jacks.
Yes.
Those are warm-ups?
Well, not for me.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I used to take water aerobics with a woman who called them jump jacks.
Jump jacks.
And I'd never heard that. I don't know whether that was just something in her family or not.
You know... Is that still part of a routine? I mean,
well, in the water it is.
Okay.
Because
I mean, I remember, not that I want to sound old, but Jack LaLanne. Speaking of jacks,
oh yeah,
he would warm up with jumping jacks.
Uh huh. Yeah. If you're lucky enough to own your own pool at home during these times, mm-hmm. and if it's really, really deep, you might do one of these classic dives.
A cannonball doesn't... Oh, a jackknife.
Mm-hmm. For the more sedentary among us, instead yes. of working out or diving, we might settle for a game of dexterity, a child's game with a bouncing ball.
Jacks.
Yeah.
You know what? I didn't play jacks till I was in my late 40s. I played with my mother-in-law.
Really?
She was bragging at this time that when she was a child, she was a champion player. Ah. It's harder than it looks.
Oh, yeah. It is. It's fun.
Because you got to keep everything in your hand yeah. and then still catch the
yeah.
ball.
Yeah, it's fun.
Okay.
And another child's game known to me as pickup sticks. Do you know the jacked up name?
No.
Jack straws. Or if you're really into laid back kid play, you might just watch the kiddo play with this surprising toy.
Oh, Jack in the Box.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Kyle, we're into adult games.
Okay.
And I've really missed the casino action during the shutdown. What's one popular table game there?
Blackjack, mm-hmm. 21, yeah.
Yep. And playing the slot machines, what is it that I hope really to do sometime?
I have never thought about how many jackpots are. Jackpot.
Hit the jackpot. Mm-hmm. Now, it's lovely out here today, but before we know it, we'll be through with summer, and we'll be watching for the late autumn weather phenomenon.
Oh, I was going to say Jack Frost.
That's it.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that in the fall? Late fall?
I guess, yeah, nipping at your nose.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Okay.
Well, of course, these days, who knows? It might be in the middle of July.
True.
And it will be past time for us to find a wild plant, also known as Indian turnip, that has a somewhat religious name.
Jack in the Pulpit.
Very good.
They're pretty.
While you're out hunting a Jack in the Pulpit, you might see a fast-starting hare.
Jackrabbit.
Yep. If instead you report seeing a rabbit with a pocket watch, a man in a white coat might put one of these on you.
Oh, I thought I knew where you were going, but a man in a white... Oh, a straight jacket!
Yeah.
Nice. I thought you were going jackalope.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This last one may be tricky, Kyle.
Okay.
Though I know if you don't get it, you'll be slapping your forehead.
Oh, boy.
Name the singing family that fits into this quiz.
Jackson 5.
Oh, very good.
All right.
Okay, Kyle, maybe Michael never could say goodbye, but I can. Bye.
That was as easy as 1, 2, 3, ABC.
Why do we need a mission to Venus? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. Venus may be Earth's closest cousin in the inner solar system, but it seems more like a distant dream to many planetary scientists. We still have yet to scratch the surface of this mysterious planet, such as what made the extreme greenhouse gas effect? Why is Venus spinning on its north pole? How active are Venus volcanoes today? What is the Venusian core made of? And why are there different types of volcanoes all over Venus? It has been nearly 30 years since NASA has sent a spacecraft to visit the planet. However, the recent downselect of planetary missions has actually given us two possible Venus missions out of four solar system finalists to compete for NASA's $500 million mission selection. The first Venus proposal, Da Vinci Plus, which means Deep Atmosphere Venus Investigation of Noble Gases, Chemistry, and Imaging, from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, would send a pressure sphere plunging through the planet's atmosphere, its instruments measuring noble gases to sort out the planet's origins, and essentially sniffing for sulfur and carbon near the surface for evidence of recent volcanic activity. The second Venus proposal, VERITAS, meaning Venus Emissivity, Radio Science, InSAR Topography, and Spectroscopy, from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, would use radar to peer through the planet's thick clouds and recreate its topography, revealing whether volcanoes or variants of plate tectonics are still active on its surface. NASA will make its decision in 2021 on the top two missions to be funded. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with your host, Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is a production of 91.3 FM, KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. This is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas.
The retailer JCPenney will close 4 stores in Arkansas as part of its Chapter 11 bankruptcy plan, including its location in Harrison. The other 3 stores are not in this region: Batesville, El Dorado, and Conway. The company says it plans to close more than 240 of its stores nationwide by the end of 2020. Talk Business and Politics reports there were 1,700 fewer construction jobs in Arkansas in April than in March. Arkansas isn't alone in the loss of construction work. According to the Associated General Contractors of America, only South Dakota did not have a decline in construction jobs in April. Arkansas PBS will continue a new set of platforms in the spirit of its Arkansas AMI that many students in the state use during the school year to learn. Camp AR PBS is designed to help children keep learning during the summer and will use online resources, programming, newsletters, blog posts, and other concepts. Resources can be accessed at myarkansaspbs.org/parents.
This is 60 Second Civics, the daily podcast of the Center for Civic Education. I'm Mark Gage. In the case of Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court changed its interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause. Linda Brown was a 7-year-old child who lived 5 blocks from an elementary school. Linda was forced to attend a school for African-American children 21 blocks away from her home. Linda's parents, along with 12 other parents, brought a lawsuit against the school board of Topeka, Kansas, saying their children had been deprived of equal protection of the law. One of the lawyers for the parents was Thurgood Marshall, an attorney for the NAACP. He argued that segregated schools could not be equal. The court agreed. It said that placing African-American children in schools separate from white children denied them the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. The court said, to separate children solely because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. Thurgood Marshall later became the first African-American justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. That's all for today's podcast. The show's theme song is Complacent by Cheryl B. Englehart. You can find Cheryl online at cbemusic.com. 60 Second Civics, where civic education only takes a minute.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Poto, Oklahoma. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. You can always find out more about us at KUAF.com. Contributors to this Tuesday night program included Antoinette Grajeda, Zuzanna Sitek, who gave us an update about the governor's task force that was announced earlier today, and Anna Stitt. Timothy Dennis mastered our show this evening from his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. Additional contributors this Tuesday night included Michael Hiblin with our partner station KUAR in Little Rock, and Catherine Sherrills, our militant grammarian. Scratching the Surface, written and hosted by Dr. Caitlin Ahrens and produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It's written and performed by Daryl Sean. We will be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. for another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. Please get rest. Please check on your friends, loved ones, and neighbors. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio tonight, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great rest of your evening.